Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
The Coaches Network, bringing the game together.
The occasion had got to me. So I remember getting up, walking to the front of the technical area, not to do anything, just to almost snap myself out of it.
Hey guys, you're now listening to the Coaches Network podcast, a podcast aimed at anyone who's passionate about athlete, talent, and personal development. My name's Coach Yas, and I'm a UEFA A-licensed football coach developer, and content creator. I'll be sitting down with a range of guests to discuss their journeys, their life lessons, and how you can make an impact. Enjoy.
Right, guys, welcome back to the Coaches Network. My name is Coach Yasser, and this morning I've got a very special guest with me. My guest this morning is Aaron Danks. Morning, Aaron. How are you?
Morning, Yas. Nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for being with us. So, Aaron, just for those that aren't familiar with who you are and what you do, would you mind just giving us a bit of a backdrop as to what that is?
Yeah, sure. So I'm currently England under 21's assistant coach. I've been with them for this season. And I've worked at the FA for the last 5 years. I think we'll speak a little bit more about the journey and where I've come from prior to that. But yeah, that's me at the moment. Thoroughly enjoying it. And obviously negotiating our way through COVID restrictions and all that kind of stuff. But yeah, it's an exciting season for us with the 21s.
Excellent. You just touched on there about the journey. I want to take you right back to the start of your journey. Where did that begin? You know, what was the first point in time where you felt, you know, coaching caught your eye, and what was it about coaching that actually caught your passion?
Yeah. So I've been a career coach, really. So I got into it really, really, really young. The age of 15, still being in school and doing like voluntary kind of Saturday morning coaching sessions. I played a little bit, but never to a decent enough standard to earn any money or get paid for playing football. So coaching was quite a it was a passion from a young age. I finished, did my GCSE exams, and then I was looking, probably thought I'd become a PE teacher or was working along those routes. Started my A-levels. I was about a month or two into my A-levels, and Birmingham City Football Club called me. I remember the phone call clearly. Called me and offered me an apprenticeship as a coach. So it was like a 2-year YTS program. I'd go to college with all the scholarship players, the youth team players, and get some, you know, BTEC certificates and diplomas in sports science, and then at the same time get my coaching badges. While they were training on the grass, I was a bag of balls, a bus pass, going into inner city schools in Birmingham and putting sessions on. So that was a brilliant foot in for me and a way in to it. So I was doing a lot of grassroots stuff, a lot of school programs, holiday camps. Yeah, and that was the first, well, I ended up being at Birmingham for 7 years, but the first two years as a YTS, and then working in the community program, running my own areas in Birmingham, raising my own funding, putting on my own holiday camps and courses and soccer sessions, and like it was kind of football for all, really. So you was working with everybody from those that were really keen to walking into schools, and there were kids in there that have never played football before. There was kids in there that weren't interested, and like trying to deliver all that kind of participation stuff. And then through the community program, moved into the academy at Birmingham, and started to look a little bit more at like working with players of higher potential, players who I've just been scouted, recruited to play in the academy. So that was the start, really. And for me, it just lit a passion around. I love the game. I fell in love with the game. Knew I wasn't good enough as a player, but wanted to contribute. And this got the bug for coaching, got the bug for seeing improvement in people, got the bug for making people smile, got the bug for communication, like all those little things that are so, so important at any level. I just got a real taste for it early and, yeah, just threw myself into it.
That's excellent. I feel quite unique, obviously, the way you started in terms of being on the YTS and them supporting you for a coaching pathway as well. You know, not something you've got often hear of. But, you know, you're spending 7 years at Birmingham. Just so, you know, it's kind of pivoting a bit more of a timeline. So you said you started around 15, going on 16. How old are you?
Yeah, so I'm 38 now. I've been doing it for over 20 years. So from Birmingham, I moved across to West Bromwich Albion. In the middle of that, I was doing some work at Solihull as well, whilst I was at Birmingham and whilst I was at West Brom. So the Solihull College piece was really helpful. So did some basic teaching qualifications, got to coach their youth team, which played in the Midland Floodlit League. So it was under 18 players, some been released by clubs. We played as a local non-league team's youth team. Competed in the evenings. It was really good, like really good. And then on the grass every day with them. So it's almost like a full-time coaching program with them. And then I'm back in at the academy, learning. Moved across to West Brom. Got introduced to Dan Ashworth, who was the academy manager at the time at West Brom. Went on to become the technical director. Met him. He had a really good vision for the club, a really good vision for the way they wanted to play, for the development program. So I moved across there. And then my first full-time role at West Brom was to set up the video analysis department. So I was still coaching. I would still work with a couple of the age groups, but it was to set up a video analysis team. So again, like what a learning experience that was for me. It was before video analysis was as professional as it is today. And I was winging it a little bit, in all honesty. But I brought a video camera. I got a laptop off the Football League. And in the daytime, I was filming under 18 sessions. I was filming under 18 games, reserve team games, working with the 18 head coach, the reserve team head coach, clipping the footage up for them, putting clips on, presenting to the players. And then in the evenings, still coaching my age groups, doing the day release programs with my age group. So I was still getting my coaching fix, but I was learning a different skill as well. Did that for a couple of years. Again, West Brom realised that video analysis needed to be a little bit more professional and get somebody in who knew what they were doing. So they employed somebody to really kick that department on, and it's now such a big part of most football clubs. And I became the 12 to 16s manager, so lead of the 12 to 16s programme. Again, brilliant experience there, working with all the different age groups in a difficult stage of players' development, because they're going through all the growth spurts and all the outside influences, and some of the players are finding their voice, some players are losing their voice, some players are going within themselves. It was just such a diverse experience. And then my last couple of years at West Brom, I was youth team coach. So I worked with the 18s on the grass every day, competing in the Cat 1 games programme, working closely with the under 23s coach. And I mean, West Brom as a club was such a good learning environment, such a good experience, especially to begin with. The first few years there, before the ECCC really kicked in and before it became a bigger beast, there was probably four or five of us that was coaching everybody. So we would be doing the under six and sevens development centre on a Friday evening, working with helping out with youth team sessions, working with the school release programs, working with the under nines all the way through to the 18s. Some Saturday mornings we were asked to take sessions with the first team players that have been left out of the match day squad. So I mean, we were coaching everybody and we were getting such a good exposure and learning experience there. Yeah, so really, really good club. And then helped the club through the ECCC process. So did the first phase of audits as 12 to 16 lead, second phase of audits as youth team coach. So I got to see two different lenses on that. And then moved across to the FA. So I've been kind of like a Birmingham, West Brom, FA, stayed in and around the Birmingham region, never had to really relocate yet in my career, but yeah, had some such diverse experiences and such great learning opportunities.
That's fantastic. And you know, you talked about a range of experiences there, both, you know, going from Birmingham to West Brom. You know, thinking about your time at West Brom, you know, I just want to talk a little bit more about that and your role as initially the 12 and 16s lead. Obviously things have changed massively over the last 10 years, as you know, especially since the ECCC came in and whatnot. What would you say some of the biggest differences are that you saw, obviously, aside from, you know, the ad hoc quote-unquote bootleg video analysis department? What would you say the major changes have been for you throughout that process from your observations?
Yeah, I think the all the academies up and down the country and the Premier League running the academies programme have done a fantastic job through the ECCC. Of highlighting some important stuff, so highlighting contact time, getting more access to the players, getting more professionalisation around coaching and coaching qualifications and coach education, and getting more bodies in the building, and not just coaches, but a multidisciplinary team. So the support network that's wrapped around the players now, I think, is exceptional. And as an international coach for the last 5 years, definitely reaps the rewards of that. So I've got to work with some fantastic players from all different parts of the UK or even around Europe now, but some great English talent that the academy program's producing. That would definitely be the strengths and the benefits of it. I think the watch outs would be sometimes the over prescription of work. So because the program gets big, because your staffing structure gets bigger, sometimes you feel the need to prescribe every session, every detail. Like, you can walk into some academies, you can pick a folder off the shelf, you can flick to 6th of January 2021, and you know the exact session that you're delivering, you know the practice design. Whereas for me as a younger coach, we didn't have that. We had a framework, we had a curriculum that we had to work from, but the practice design was up to you. And I made so many mistakes. I designed so many practices that didn't work and failed, and had to get feedback and recognize, oh, I'm going to do it again, but I'm going to tweak that little bit and make that area bigger or take that rule out. That was too complicated. And so I had to make loads of mistakes. And I just wonder if we do that enough as coaches, we allow the coaches enough room to make their own mistakes and learn from them. I think there's, coach development is player development. The better we improve our coaches, the better we improve our players. And sometimes we can get lost with that. So, yeah, but I mean, lots of differences, lots of change, not just over 10 years, over 20 years, over 30 years. Lots of coaches, top coaches now who are good players, professional players. You speak to them about their upbringing and they were never coached. They played street football. They played five sides in training. The senior players roughed them up in the dressing room to make sure they got the messages. And now we've got this really professionalized coaching network where the players get everything done for them. They know where they need to be, what to do, to be told. And just sometimes I think there's a trade-off in there somewhere. There's a trade-off between the street baller and the really professionalized coaching structure. And that excites me as a coach, just to explore that, tap into that and think, right, what can we do here? How can we still produce a street footballer under a safe, highly detailed environment that we have?
Just on that, obviously, you know, I think a lot of that obviously is due to societal changes as well. You know, it's becoming, you know, certainly when I was younger and probably when you were as well, and we used to be able to go out on the street and just play willingly without, you know, worrying about having to pay for anything or, you know, someone coming to pick us up and, you know, run off with us and that sort of thing. And it, you know, it sounds crazy to say, but it is one of the biggest fears at the moment and for a lot of parents. And, you know, even finding facilities now to actually go and play is becoming increasingly difficult. Even parks, they're not leaving the goals up as long as they used to. So I guess, you know, you're right, there is going to be a trade-off in that respect. But, you know, what would you say are some of the things that, you know, outside of the obvious of being able, in terms of being able to play with any random different age groups and different types of people, what would you say are some of the obvious things that you see as benefits of having that street element to it?
Yeah, I think we need to notice this, and we need to be creative about our thoughts around it. So I agree 100% with your messaging around, like, access to facilities, places, safe places to go and play. But I just think we can be way more creative about how we look at that. So schools keeping the gates open longer, and lots of the schools in Birmingham now have got AstroTurfs on their playgrounds. So it's like, well, I don't know, rather than throwing thousands and thousands of pounds at building new 4Gs and building new facilities and trying to get more access, which then costs a lot to rent and hire those facilities, can't we like throw a load of money at the caretakers and get them to open the gates and get them to let the kids in and play? And like, so I think we can be really creative and look at these kind of stuff if we think it's important and if we recognize that those important things. The street footballer for me, the qualities of the street footballer was he could self-organize. So he could find three or four other lads and get a game going. He could manage the teams. If one team was too strong, right, you come and play on my team and flip that over. So their game intelligence was actually really high. Their game management was really good. You often played on horrible surfaces, gravelly pitches, concrete, where you didn't want to fall over, you didn't want to slip, you didn't want to slide. So your balance was really good. Your control had to be really good. The creativity, the technical creativity then coming off the back of that. So little scoop passes to get over the curb and get into a goal scoring position, a little 1-2 off a wheel of a car, like all those little things, they learn a lot from themselves. They self-organize themselves. So for me, it's recognizing that in our coaching and just recognizing as a coach now to go, right, okay, how can I create an environment of play? What age groups is that really important with? I would argue lots. And what's my style of coaching going to be? So when do I need to come in and support? When do I need to come in and offer some guidance, to help them with some pictures, show them something that they might not be noticing? And there's definitely a space for that. There's definitely, we all know that the coaching is part, is that. But I just think sometimes creating a really good learning environment does almost 80% of your work for you. And then you as the coach comes in and does that last 20%. We had a coaching model at the FA where we spoke about the plan, do, review cycle quite a lot. We split it down into the plan the learning, create the learning environment, coach the learning, and then review the learning. So that doing bit in the middle, we split in half into create the environment first, see how much of it can take care of itself, and then you come in and do the coaching as and when you need to. So that excites me, all that practice design stuff and looking at those little nuances to develop these kind of street creative football players. Yeah, really excites me.
No, brilliant. Thank you for that. And obviously talking there about the coaching philosophy or the way in which you guys are set up and, you know, helping as coaches to breed more character and more of those qualities out of players. I'm just interested to know about yourself then in terms of your own coaching philosophy and what the fundamentals are for you and how that differs to maybe some of the environments you've worked in. More specifically, have you ever found that you've had to maybe hold back on some of the way that you want to work because of the environment you're currently working in or were working in at that time?
Yeah, it's a great question. In terms of my coaching philosophy, you know, I revisit this so often, like every 3 months, probably sit down and do myself a new slide deck and had a couple of new bullet points in. Or the FA has been really good for me in that. So working at the FA is a slightly different pace to working in the club environment where you're on the grass every day in the club world. And whereas the FA can be a bit more reflective, I kind of liken it to going to university. So yeah, real masterclass learning environment. But you get time to self-reflect, you get time to study. And the FA, in the England DNA, it speaks about how we play, how we coach, how we support the future England player. So it like breaks down your philosophy into smaller chunks. So I've kind of done that really. So I'd have a playing philosophy in my head, which would be quite adaptable. I'd have a coaching philosophy in my head, like what I think coaching sessions look like. And then I'd have like a cultural philosophy in my head, like what kind of environments I think players benefit from, I benefit from, suit me down to the ground. And there's definitely been a little bit of a roller coaster with that, but I've been lucky that I've worked with, for some great leaders and in some great environments where they've trusted me and they've allowed me to flourish and they've given me the freedom to go and do my work and really express myself. I think that's where I'm at my best. But what those organisations did do was they give me clear direction, give me a goal, a purpose, and a sense of belonging to that. So I think that, again, I felt that was really, really important. For me personally, I've probably got 3 bullet points that jump out to me around compete, joy, and perspective. So compete for me is like we compete in everything we do every single day. People listening to this podcast are competing. They want to get better. They want to learn. They want to improve. That's it for me. That process of not winning, not hanging everything on 3 points, hanging everything on winning a trophy, hanging everything on at some point in my career, I want to win the Champions League or I want to win the Premier League. Because I don't think there is a destination. I don't think there is a happy place in terms of that. I think the happy place is that every single day you're getting up to be better. Every single day I'm getting up to compete. I want my sessions to be competitive. I want the players to be competitive. I want them to understand every day is about improvement. Every day is about them competing against themselves and getting a better version of themselves out. so that's the compete element. The joy element, the enjoyment, the fun, the best people I've worked with have made me laugh. The best environments I've been in, I've felt relaxed, happy, I've smiled. We've had a whale of a time. We've laughed. Sometimes we've cried together. Sometimes we've hurt. Sometimes we've been in pain. Sometimes we've argued. Sometimes we've rowed. But like any family, we laugh way more and we have way more fun than we do those. And that's what gets you through those difficult times. So that enjoyment piece. Some of my mentors, I just look back at their coaching styles and they were funny. They were cracking jokes in sessions. They were making players laugh. When they needed to, they were tough. When they needed to tell, they told. When they needed to shout, they shouted. And I think it had a bigger impact because they connected with people. And then the last bit with the perspective piece is a really interesting word. I was lucky enough to visit a few different organizations. I went to Golden State Warriors and they used this word a lot about perspective. I was talking to them about like competing in the biggest moments, the biggest games and in playoff games and in championship games. And they said, yeah, but as long as the players have got perspective on what it all means, it's not that big an issue. Like they just get through it and they just deal with it. And I was like, wow. Like, and then they were talking about coaching perspective. They coach perspective. They always, I'm like, well, how? Like, what do you mean? It was like, well, I went there the end of Black History Month, and they're just adding two black athletes in to talk about their times. They did a human rights stand on the podium, got stripped of their medals. It was interpreted as a black power thing, and they get kicked out of the Olympic Village. But it was to give their young black athletes perspective on athletes that had gone before them, who had given them the rights and the privileges that they had today and suffered. And I used to have a saying as a young coach around talent needs trauma, and looked at lots of top athletes, and they'd come from traumatic backgrounds or from different circumstances. And what the battle I was having with myself was, what about the middle class player that's come through a really nice environment? Have I got to make something traumatic for him? Have I got to expose him to something? So actually, I've rephrased it to talent needs perspective. And I work with super talented, high potential players that earn a lot of money early, that get given a lot to them early, that get a lot of privileges early in life. And I think if they don't have perspective on life and perspective on what all that means, and continue to compete and continue to have fun, they can get lost in the game. So I think giving them perspective, asking them their opinions. I want to know their perspective. I want to know their perspective on the game plan. I want to know their perspective on life. I want to know their perspective on George Floyd. I want to know their perspective on everything and anything, really. Their perspective on Love Island, their perspective on Gogglebox. Do you know what I mean? We'll get into these conversations just to connect with people and just to get their voice and develop their leadership skills and develop their communication skills. And I just think that's a big part of coaching, a big part of my beliefs in coaching. So them three things get me up and drive me every day, really. And I want to bring them to my coaching all the time.
And you touched on a couple of things there. I'm just going to pick on the first one, that last bit about leadership and looking at different ways and you're connecting with people. And obviously, leadership is a fascinating thing for me, because there's so many different ways in which it can be done. And, I'm sure you'd agree, is that it needs to be done in different ways for different people to meet their own needs and get the best out of those. Over the years now, having worked in the roles that you have worked in up to now, what would you say your roles have taught you about leadership itself?
For me or the player?
Both, really. I mean, but if you're looking back at your journey as a young player and moving into the coaching world, you would have seen probably over the years, you probably see some great examples of great leadership that maybe potentially could have been missing when you were younger, or had you had those elements in your upbringing, that maybe your path might have been different as well, potentially.
Yeah, I think leadership's complicated. So if we start off with you as a coach and your leadership abilities, so I've led phases in academies, I've led youth teams, I've led coaches and led a team of coaches towards a goal, and my God, it's tough. It has to be personalised, it has to be different for individuals, it has to be you can't lead one way and expect everybody to follow. If you want to get followers, if you want to inspire people, you have to find different ways of leading different people. So I found that really, really complex. And I've made so many mistakes with that, even recently, even in the last few years of leading coaches and leading people. I think sometimes, I shouldn't have said that. I tripped over my words there. I didn't mean that. I had the best of intentions to move in this direction. And actually, we've gone in that direction. And so leadership is really, really complicated. And I take that then onto the field. So when we talk about leaders in the game and leaders on the pitch and player leaders, they come in all different shapes and sizes, like you say. And some are quiet leaders, some are inspirational in their actions, some are vocal, some are loud. I'm fortunate now that I can still get into certain games and scout players and watch players, even with the lockdown restrictions, but the stadiums are empty. So you can hear lots. You can hear the vocal ones. You can hear the ones that their voice bellows around the stadium and it echoes, and you can hear it so clear. And then the quiet ones. And you can see the coaches on the touchline are very similar as well. There's some quiet ones. There's some that come up when they need to come up. There's some that are there nonstop. There's some dugouts that has got three or four people shouting onto the pitch. And so leadership's different. What I get frustrated with is this conversation I hear so much of, is there's no leaders in the game anymore. Players don't communicate enough with Generation Z or whatever we're in now, and the mobile phones and the way that they communicate now. And I get it. I understand why people are having those conversations. But sometimes I just worry that actually, in what spaces are we giving them an opportunity to lead? In what spaces are we giving them an opportunity to communicate? So that's, again, back to my perspective piece, really. I want to know their perspective. I want to know how they feel. And sometimes peer-to-peer coaching is way more impactful than me saying it. Like, I've had examples of, like, there's a shot in a game. If he'd have squared it across, his mate had an easier goal scoring position. I could have said that point, but it came from one of the centre halves behind. It came from one of the big defenders, and he said to me, like, square that, it's a tap in. Like, and that, they can speak in a language to each other sometimes. It's way more impactful. So I just think the leadership stuff, I think it sometimes can be too easy a comment to say there's no leaders in the game. It can be too easy a comment to say players are different now, players have changed, players don't communicate. It's like, well, okay, but what are we going to do about it? I always want to find the solution. I always want to, rather than moan about the problem, I want to find the solution. I want to go, right, okay, well, we need to give them sessions where we're quiet and they've got to talk. We need to give them spaces in their training sessions, huddles, where they can get together and they can talk, discuss about what the plan is or what the opposition are doing, what problems they're causing to them, how we can find solutions. And I think they're the leadership and the communication skills we have a responsibility to develop, as much as we've got a responsibility to develop a Cruyff turn or a whipped finish. We've got a responsibility to develop a communication skill, a leadership, a bravery to step forward and say something, a bravery to put their hand up and challenge what the coach has said or ask a question on what the coach has said. These are the players that we need to thrive in the biggest moments, the biggest games, to win World Cups, to, we need teams of people. So I go off on one, but I'm really passionate about it.
No, I think it's fascinating. I think it's really, for me, leadership such a, it's such a, you know, it has so much depth to it, because, you know, you've got to be so conscious of so many different variables. You know, like, you know, you talked about earlier on about, you know, the street play or the middle class play, or, you know, but that's just looking at it from one potential environment. Never mind, you know, what people come from, different cultures, different countries, different backgrounds, and how certain things might affect them, you know. I was having this conversation over there, you might have some cultures where actually looking at someone in the eye is a sign of respect. In other cultures, it's, you don't look at people in the eye. It's just looking at all these little subtle things and thinking, right, yeah, how well, and it coming back to the piece that you were talking about earlier about that joy piece and having jokes and just really connecting with the people, just to understand, right, what are they about? What makes them tick? What they, you know, what do they enjoy? What do they not enjoy? How do they feel? And, you know, just looking at every aspect of that individual. And I think that is obviously all falls into that leadership piece. Now, speaking of that joy piece that you mentioned earlier, you know, you talked there about watching some of your mentors and when they were working, and they, you know, they were always conscious to, you know, maybe throw a little bit of a joke in there and whatnot, just to kind of, you know, when it was needed, and obviously when they needed to be tough, they could be tough. On that note, I'm just interested to know who some of those mentors are for you, and maybe what were some of the biggest lessons that you've kind of pulled away from them.
Yeah, for sure. Again, this is something that I think about a lot. Think about what is a mentor, who have been my mentors, who's currently mentoring me, who's currently helping me. And I've just been so fortunate to work around so many different good people. I always think there's two or three coaches that have had a really big impact on me. So Dan Ashworth, who was the academy manager, then TD at West Brom, TD at England, was actually a really, really talented coach, had really good communication skills, really good practice design, learned so much from him. Prior to him at Birmingham, there was a academy manager called Stuart Hall. Stuart did some of the FA coach education work as well. Again, Stuart was really creative with his coaching, great personality, always delivered with personality, and really got us thinking as young coaches about detail around delivery and that. Came across a coach called Roger Wilkinson. So Roger worked, he set up a coaching company in England with John Cartwright, who's more London-based, John, and their coaching company was all around practice play, and it was all around street football, really. It was all around recreating street football environments and developing individuals within a team sport, developing skillful players. Now, Roger, again, he cracks a joke every 5 minutes, but his coaching detail as well on top of that was fantastic. So those guys all had a massive impact on me. But that's not to be disrespectful of some of the other leaders that I've worked for who are fantastic. So Mark Harrison is the academy manager at West Brom, Matt Crocker at the FA, all give me different skills around organisation, around vision, around planning. But do you know what? Deep down, probably some of your best mentors are peers, not necessarily people that you would like. I always thought of a mentor as like this guru that you'd hold up in this. And some of those people I've mentioned are that really. They are the guru figures. But some of my best mentors have been my best mates. And Jimmy Shan, we coached together from the start, really. We did the Birmingham community stuff together. We worked in Birmingham Academy together. We went to West Brom together. We just grew up together as coaches. He's almost my coaching brother, really. And we would just do sessions together and go, oh, what did you say that for? What did you mean by that? And I thought of these three words, these three buzzwords that are going to get the players' attention better next time. And we just nudged each other and we poked each other and we prodded each other and we learned from each other. And we actually haven't worked on that for the last 5 years, but he's still somebody that we hold dearly and learn a lot from. And sometimes it's like it's not a guru mentor. It's somebody on the front line with you. It's somebody that's next to you. It's your co-coach or it's your a mate, a friend who really gives you those little nudges and those little pokes and prods. In terms of the biggest learnings, the biggest lessons, I remember I used to have like little notepads all the time wherever I went. I still do now, but making notes. And I had one and I wrote it on the cover of the notepad because I thought, oh, I love that quote. I didn't really know what it meant, but Stuart Hall said, people don't care what you know till they know that you care. Oh, that's really good. Like, I like that one. So I wrote it on the front of my notepad and then made my notes on tactics and all that kind of stuff. And I kept coming back to it. And, you know, it's only really as you probably mature and you get a little bit more emotional intelligence, you understand people, you really understand what that quote means. Like, genuinely, I've seen so many.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Coaches, such good detail that just cannot connect with people. And then I've seen some people that can really, really connect with people, but then don't have the, well, maybe the detail or the impact to follow it up. But for me, like, to try and start with knowledge is the wrong place. Like, you have to start with connection. You have to get people to know that you care, people to know that you're there for the right reasons. I'm not an ex-player. I don't walk into a room and command respect because I played in Champions League finals and I achieved this or did that. Not at all, not at all. And I know that. I get that respect from people by building respect, by getting to know them, by them getting to know me. And I've worked with so many different players that have played at all different levels, and I've never ever had an issue with respect. I've always managed to get that just by being myself and being personable and getting to know them. So I think that's been the biggest impact on me as a coach from one of those mentors was around understanding connections, the most important thing.
Fantastic, thank you for that. And I just want to kind of bring you back to something you touched on there about, you know, being able to command respect and some of the achievements that people may have had, and that's helped them obviously go in certain environments now. I think on that note, I just want to talk about some of the achievements you've had obviously over the last few years in particular. You know, if we look back at your time with the FA, take you back to 2017, you were part of the England under 20 side that ended up winning the World Cup. What was that like?
Yeah, incredible, absolutely incredible experience. We were hanging on the coattails of some really good people. So some really good people have worked with that age group before and done some really good work at the club for those players. So we cannot take the credit for the win. Like, I got a medal, I got a gold medal, but there was probably 30 other people in that chain that deserved that medal as much as me. So they'd been this age group had been European champions with John Peacock. They'd reached under-19s European Championship finals the year before with Aidy Boothroyd, which qualified them for the World Cup. I'm really humble and cautious of taking credit for that achievement. But I was part of it. I was out there and I loved every minute of it. Like, the experience of it, the intensity of it was fantastic. The level of opposition, been at a World Cup, in our World Cup's run. This competition is the second competition that FIFA organise and FIFA deliver. So to be part of that was outstanding. We play Argentina opening game, and our record at the World Cup, at under-20s World Cups, had been poor really over the last 30 years. So we're playing Argentina first game, and genuinely our thought process as coaches going into that was just win the first game. Just wanted to win the first game. We just wanted to get a win under our belts and then see where the competition took us. So Argentina opening game, we're coming in off the back of a tough Premier League season. Some players playing, some players get released late, coming to us late. We had a week in Japan just to train, get the lads prepared, and then fly over to South Korea and play Argentina. Argentina had like a month together. The week before they're playing us, they're playing, I think it was Vietnam, and they've got like 40,000 people in the stadium and like this real buzz to send them off to the World Cup. So we turn up, we play them, and they're ready for it. I think they were better prepared for that opening game than we were, and they absolutely dominated us. We won the game 3-0, we were really good in both 18-yard boxes. We got dominated in between the two 18-yard boxes. But we won 3-0. We were clinical. We took our chances. They had a red card in the second half. We were already ahead in the game. They had a red card in the second half. Martinez, the centre-forward, who's now at Milan, I think, he elbowed one of our players on the touchline. It was one of the first ever VAR red cards. So all those little moments, like, you still come back to you and you get excited. But what we did from that moment forward was we improved every game. You know, the biggest credit I can give to the players and to the staff was we went on a journey. We believed in our processes. We believed in our organisation. We just game on game. Drew the second game with Guinea. Won the third game against South Korea to top the group, which gave us a really nice path to the final. We had evening kickoffs. We had less travel. So they're really good. And some fantastic games along the way. Mexico beating them down to 10 men. Played Italy in the semi-final. So Italy had beat us in the European Championship semi-finals in 2019. We get them in the World Cup semi-finals in 2016. Sorry, we get them in the World Cup semi-finals in 2017. And they They were typically Italian, like really good defensively, really well drilled, really well disciplined. One of our players said, like, oh, if we concede the first goal, we're in trouble. We went 1-0 down after 3 minutes. So you talk about perspective. We asked the players for their perspective. We asked their players for what it was like last time we played them. Oh, if they score first, we're in trouble. They score first after 3 minutes. We're all sitting there going, oh my God, why did we ask that question? Like, that's at the forefront of all our minds. But the boys stuck to the game plan. They were excellent. We ended up winning that game 3-1. And then the World Cup final itself, to be involved in a game like that, Venezuela, their head coach had dropped down, their senior manager had dropped down to take their 20s through the tournament. They're some super talented young players. Dogged team, really worked so hard for each other. And I remember being sat in the dugout, and we're probably 15 minutes into the game, and I am literally glazed over. I don't know what's like. I'm taking nothing in. I'm absorbing nothing. I haven't spoke to any of the assistant coaches. I haven't spoke to the head coach. I couldn't tell you tactically what was going on in the game. Like the occasion had got to me. So I remember getting up, walking to the front of the technical area, not to do anything, just to almost snap myself out of it. Went back, sat down, made a couple of notes in my notepad. And from that moment on, I was back into my process. I was back into the routine. But just to have that experience of that magnitude of a game. And ultimately, that's what we were there for. We were there to expose the players to such a big occasion that, touch wood, fingers crossed, when they reach those occasions again, when they get those experiences again, they're better for it. They're ready for it. We know that we want a senior team to win a World Cup. We know that's what our goal is and our objective is. And I know for a fact, everybody that was involved in that definitely got some fantastic learning from it, some fantastic experiences. But to come home, to fly back into Birmingham, to have my wife and kids meet me at the airport and get a photo with the trophy before it gets whirled away and puts in a box somewhere or in a display case somewhere, to get the kids to have a photo with the trophy and stuff like that. To experience that was like, yeah, gold dust, really. Such special memories and such special people to experience that with, the players and the staff. Yeah, it was wonderful. Really, really good.
I think, you know, just hearing you talk about it, I can just imagine the depth of the size of the occasion must have been quite overwhelming to start with. But obviously, you've got to get snapped back in. You can't be starstruck. You can't be left in any situation like that. But you know, your time obviously during that phase of working in the 20s was it was quite a unique role. Lead in possession coach for maybe those that aren't too familiar with what that looks like, and you know, what you do in that role, what does that look like?
Yeah, we didn't buy success, but around that really successful period, there was a massive investment from the FA, and that shouldn't go unnoticed. So the FA invested a lot of money, and time, and resource into making sure we were some of the best prepared teams in the tournaments that we were going to, and part of that was to look at our coaching setup. And think about, right, how can we do this differently? And there were some really innovative leaders that really tried to stretch and think about how can we coach differently to any other nation? How can we get a competitive advantage from our training sessions? And one of the ways that we looked at that, and it was only one of the ways, but was to employ what we called specialist coaches. So in layman's terms, it was assistant coaches with a real specific role and responsibility. Now, I'm not saying this doesn't happen. This definitely happens at clubs in first team environments where you've got the resource, where you have a head first team coach, a head coach or a manager, and he'll have assistant coaches with specific roles that, like, I'm going to look after set pieces, I'm going to look after this. And all we did was we split those roles into in and out of possession, so attack and defence, really. So we employed coaches to work with our age groups. We obviously had head coaches for every age group. And then we had a team of in-possession coaches and a team of out-of-possession coaches. So we went to the World Cup with head coach Paul Simpson, in-possession coach myself, out-of-possession coach Andy Edwards, and a goalkeeping coach Richard Hartis, and then the analyst Alex Scott. And we kind of built this kind of pack of five of us. And it was all about how welcome us five work together to give us a competitive advantage. I would really take responsibility and ownership of us when we've got possession of the ball. The out of possession coach would do the same on defence. What that meant was I would study how Argentina are going to press us, what their mid block's going to look like, how they defend their goal, and come up with a game plan to really exploit that. The out of possession coach would look at how Argentina are going to attack, how they're going to build from their goalkeeper, how they create their goal scoring chances, and to put a defensive plan in place. We'd present that to the head coach. Head coach would sign off or would challenge or would tweak or would say, I've noticed this as well. And so the head coach's role was there to kind of facilitate that and to guide it and to lead it. And then how skillfully can we work together on the grass? So my role grew quite quickly from being an in-possession coach with one age group to then becoming the lead in-possession coach. So I kind of facilitated that group of coaches. I wouldn't say I was the guru figure. I was telling people what to do. I was facilitating discussions. What are you doing with the 19s that we can learn from? What do the seniors want? What does it look like with the first team? I was facilitating lots of those conversations, not talking about best practice, but probably talking about best principles. What are the principles that we can share? I did that for a couple of years, and then I was asked by Dan Ashworth and Matt Crocker to become the head of specialist coaching, so to oversee the in and the out of possession. I had a coach called Richie Kyle who led the out of possession work and supported me a lot with this. And then my role then was to really kind of think about what does good specialist coaching look like? How do we get these coaches working together while on the grass? And what we definitely didn't want it to look like was silos. We definitely didn't want it to be it's the in-possession coach's turn to coach now, and the out-of-possession coach and the head coach are still in the touchline with their arms folded. In the head coaches, some of the head coaches to begin with were like, what's this about? Like, I want to coach. I want to be a coach. And 100% that's what the model was there for. The model was there for how do we get you all interacting in a session to add value to the players? So we speak about things like, who's got a broad lens on the practice, who's overseeing the practice, who's doing the timings, who's doing the rules, the constraints, who might have Zoom focus just on a unit or an area of the pitch, or I might just look at the back four in this exercise, and then who might have laser precision and just be looking at one individual or one specific technical aspect. It might be a cross coming into the box. It might be I'm only looking at our number 10's back foot receiving in this session. That is it. That's my laser focus and that's my detail. And we got some really, really good coaching going with it, some really good work, some really good learning environments. And players were all the players. So let's say there's 22 players on that training pitch that day. They won't all leave with the same message. They will leave with individualized work specific to their international development plan or what they're working on and what they need to get better at. So that's what it looked like. And it was different for me. It was really, as a coach coming into it, I was uncertain of what specialist coaching was. I was uncertain of what an in-possession coach was. It definitely enabled me to delve into the detail, definitely enabled me to challenge and stretch my coaching. And as a coach coming out of it, so now I'm just an assistant coach where I'll look at after the in and the out of possession and I'll balance that off with the head coach and with the goalkeeping coach. So we're back down to a team of three now. Coming out of it, it's definitely got me thinking differently about coaching. It's got me thinking differently about, right, how can I really help the head coach here lead this session? So if the head coach is leading the session on us in possession, what can I be doing? Does he want me reinforcing the in-possession messages? Does he want me opposing the in-possession messages? Does he want me competing against it? Does he want me to try and cause it some problems? So these are the conversations we will have a lot as a coaching team now to think about, right, how are we going to interact with each other? How are we going to work together as a team of coaches to add value to every session? I learned loads from it. And again, just taking some best principles from it and keeping that in my coaching.
I think you make a great point there, because I say to coaches all the time, one of the biggest skills that I learned over the most recent years was actually how to work effectively with other coaches. I think for a lot of us, when we first start, we tend to be the only coach, or we're working as an assistant or working with an assistant, where it's, I'm going to step in, you'll step back, or vice versa. And, you know, finding that right balance of, right, we can both work at the same time, but how much are you going to be in there? How much am I going to be in? And just balancing that, I think that's a really important skill. I think that certainly as you go up levels, where you know, as you talk, there's, you know, the resources are there. There is more people on site. There is more people on board, not just on the grass, but even off the grass. And how we're working together, I think, is a massive, massive part to play. So I guess, you know, just on that then, you know, I'm interested to know, having those range of experiences, you know, going back right to the start of your journey to now, you know, working as a lead coach, working as a youth team coach, working as an in possession specialist, working obviously now as an assistant coach in a range of other roles that I'm sure in between and around that. What would you say is one of the biggest challenges that you've had to deal with throughout that journey? And it could be not on the field, Matt, or it could be an off the field thing. And if you've been able to deal with it, fantastic, great. How have you gone about dealing with it? And is it something, or it could be something that you're still currently facing and still thinking about how you're going to get over it?
Yeah. Good, really good question, Yaz. I've lost players to illness, have passed away. I've been involved in child protection issues. I've had some really, really dark times and really difficult times that I've had to deal with. But they've all made me stronger. They've all, I use them all as inspiration and as focus and reflect on them. In all honesty, one of the hardest times I've had to deal with is probably the current period around COVID. And I see this for lots of people. The lack of getting into St George's Park and treating St George's Park as a training facility and bumping into each other and having conversations and that social interaction, I found really, really difficult, really tough. And adapting to this world, screen presentations, podcasts, talking virtually, meeting people has been wonderful, has been really, really good, really beneficial. And I hope that continues. I hope the coaching community recognize the benefits of this kind of stuff and continue to promote it and use it moving forward. But looking at grassroots game, looking at players who are missing out on the development opportunities, I find it incredibly difficult at the moment. I think that potentially we are at risk of a lost generation of players. Look at the last 12, 18 months, grassroots game. When it's allowed to be on. I know so many grassroots coaches have worked so hard to deliver safe environments, to deliver safe sessions, to really maximise the moments when they've been able to get back with the players, to offer them virtual sessions when they're not around, not available. International football has took a massive hit throughout, and understandably and rightly so, in a global pandemic. But we've been able to deliver less camps, been able to get together with the players less, been fortunate with the under-21s and the senior team that we've created safe bubbles, and we've had really good testing, and we can still get our games on, and we've still had travel exemptions to go to different countries and put games on. But even then, the restrictions that you're working under, how often can you meet the players? How often do the players have to be in their hotel room on their own? It's tough, so, so tough. And it really challenges what the environments that you try and create really challenges. Like, we want that family feel, we want that connection, we want to be sat together, we want to be having lunch together, we want to be watching the telly together, we want to, and actually, do you know what we've been told? Like, restrictions, no, you've got to be in your own room, you can meet for 15 minutes, you can only meet in groups of six, you can, so doing lots of learning outdoors, doing lots of learning on the training pitch. Yeah, it's been a massive, massive challenge. I think it's been a huge challenge for everybody. And that's without getting into the personal side of it, of bereavements and people people losing family members and the suffering and the mental health and well-being of people going through this global pandemic. So I've got to say, this has probably been the toughest part of my coaching journey, my coaching career. I'm really fortunate in the position that I'm in to be in work. Although I've seen some really good people lose their roles, lose their jobs through this and through the cutbacks and stuff. So yeah, I mean, it's been tremendously difficult. Still working out what it means. There's light at the end of the tunnel with the vaccinations. There's obviously the Premier League still going on, and there's still football for us to watch, which is fantastic and great. But there's so many people that are missing out at the moment on coaching, on learning, and on play and kids and stuff like that. So yeah, I think I've got to say this has been really difficult.
No, I appreciate that. It's certainly been a challenging time for everyone. I think, you know, mediums like this have definitely helped people just kind of stay positive and motivated, and, you know, to keep going. You know, and on that note, you know, I'm interested to know for yourself, you know, obviously having gone through all the challenges that you have gone through, and obviously off the back of what you've just mentioned there, what is it for you that helps you stay inspired and motivated to keep going and, you know, being the best you can?
Yeah, I think in a word, coaching. So I think in a word, like if we sum coaching up as helping people, making people better, seeing improvement in people, connecting with people, building relationships, developing people, teaching, learning, all that kind of stuff, that's what inspires me more than anything else. Just that day-to-day process, that daily process of getting better, making people better, improving people, that inspires me so much. And I'll walk through, when possible, I walk through shopping centres in Birmingham and I have players stopping me that I coached in the college programme 15 years ago, Birmingham Academy, when they were 10-year-olds, and they're now 23-year-olds, and I'm like trying to recognise who they are and trying to get a name out of them, and then it clicks and they're flipping out. Like, just having that connection with people and staying in touch with players that you've worked with, that inspires me. The game inspires me. I love the game. I love the sport. I love sport in general. I'm an innovative thinker, so I'm always thinking about, oh, come on, where can we take it next? What's next? What can we do? How can we grow it? How can we improve it? Not just in my world, but in the grassroots game and everything, really. Like, how can we make the game better for everybody? So yeah, that inspires me. And you know what, in my days of feeling down and feeling low, I turn to football. So I'll go and like download a game from South America and go and watch Boca Juniors, or I'll watch Rangers last week, or I'll watch different teams from around the world, some of that I haven't watched recently, and I'll go and do a little study on them, and that just infuses me again to go again. So I'm a bit weird in that regard, that I just turn to football when I need inspiration for football. So well, no, my family are great with it. Like, they're all tolerant. My little boy loves the game as well, so that gets me going. Just keep that passion, really.
Yeah, no, excellent. You talking about the love of the game, you know, I think the game is it brings so many emotions, in all different ways. I'm just interested to know now, you know, having a range of experiences, as much as you've got that love for the game, and we've all got them. I know I've got mine. I'm just interested to know what your bugbears are when it comes to the game, more specifically with coaching.
Yeah, what are my bugbears with coaching? I aim this at myself. So ego. I used to think that coach was the king, and at times I still do. If somebody asks me what's your best image of coaching, I've got this video clip of Guardiola coaching Bayern Munich in Doha, and he's in the session, he's animated, he's centric, he's like, he's detail, he's passion, he's running around. It's like a 7-minute clip. In that clip, I think the ball rolls for about 2 minutes, and the danger is, I don't know the periodization, I don't know what he's doing, I don't know, understand the week, I don't understand why he's doing that session at that moment, or why he's using that coaching style at that moment. So I've taken it out of context and looked at it and gone, that's brilliant coaching, I'm going to be like that. And my ego wants to be front and center, wants to be in the middle of things, wants to be running practices, running shows, and I want it to all be about me and my knowledge and my, and that was me very much as a young coach. And I look at it now and I just cringe so much. I think, oh my gosh, get out of the way. Like, let the players, not let the game be the teacher. The coach is important. The environment's important. Let the game be there and the coach be part of the teaching process most definitely. But sometimes get your ego out of the way. And that's a bugbear. I see it all the time. I see it in coaches. I see it in coaching courses, coaching qualifications. But we create that environment. The course sometimes creates that environment of, like, you feel like you're being assessed. I feel like I need to get my knowledge out. A bugbear for me personally, making sure I leave my ego at the door, making sure that it's not about me, it's about the players, it's about the players' needs. And I'll be there and I'll be ready and I'll be impact and I'll compete every day to be the best version of me that I can be. So when I'm needed, I can add value 100%. That'll be the one for me.
You know, just to kind of follow up on that, as we start to wind down now, then, you know, if we now take a look back at your journey, you know, all the experience you've had, and now talking about some of your bugbears, we take you back to, you know, that 15, 16 year old stepping into the coaching world. What would be one message you'd like to give Aaron Danks back then, if you had the opportunity?
I'm cheating a little bit here because this is, it's not a New Year's resolution, but it's kind of like a New Year's quote for myself or a statement. I'm reflecting on my journey and where I'm at now. And I use this with my kids. So I speak about eyes up, dream big, head down, work hard. And I guess the message there is, go back to my young coaching self, eyes up, dream big. Like, don't ever let anybody tell you you can't achieve your dreams. You can't. I mean, I'm now coaching nationally. I'm now working with England under 21s. And think of that as a 15-year-old. Like, wow. Never thought I'd be able to get to that point in my coaching career. So I remember going to the Birmingham County FA. It was a coach education session. I was probably about 17 or 18. And you had to write down on a piece of paper what your dream was as a coach, what your ambition was as a coach. And I wrote down, I wanted to coach a England youth team. And I wrote on a piece of paper and swapped it with the person next to me. And you had to read each of us out. And this guy read it out as he wants to coach an England team. And he got laughed. He got laughed at in the room. I always remember it getting laughed at. And I, by the age of 34, 35, I'd achieved it. Like, I was working with England youth teams and I was like, flipping hell, like, I remember that. And I remember, like, I've achieved. So I'd always say, keep your eyes up and dream big. But there's no real destination. There's no real endpoint. There's no real, like, I won a World Cup, but that's not enough. Like, I want to do more. And that's not give me ultimate happiness, and I'm not at some holy grail because I've achieved that. It's the head down, work hard bit I actually think is the happy point. I actually think, get your head down, work hard, enjoy every day, enjoy the process, enjoy the grind, enjoy having to do the PMA and the heart and, like, the stuff that you don't, like, you get in there and get that done, and that day-to-day bit, head down, work hard, I think is the happy place. So eyes up, dream big, head down, work hard, and try and use it with my kids. Try and keep that for me as well now in my career. So you achieved everything you wanted to achieve. Like, you've coached England youth team. So what's next? Well, eyes up, dream big, definitely. But if you want to get anywhere, you want to achieve anything, it's just about head down, work hard, and keep going.
So speaking of eyes up, dreaming big, what is next for Aaron Danks?
I don't know. I get asked the question lots. I'm enjoying where I'm at. I'm enjoying the under 21s challenge. So we go into March where we're actually into the finals of the European Championship. So the way they're doing it this year, if they've split it in half. So the group stage of the Euros is in March and then the quarters, semis and the final is in May. So we go into a tough group stage in March. We've got Switzerland, Croatia and Portugal. We need to qualify from the group to come back in May. I'm enjoying that. Head down, work hard, get be the best prepared we can be going into it. Looking at the players, looking at what they're doing at the clubs, looking at the intensity that they're going through currently, trying to help aid the head coach be as prepared as we can be. I'm thoroughly looking forward to that. Beyond that, it will be the head down, work hard bit that dictates where I am next. It won't necessarily be. Eyes up, dream big is there, and I want to have goals. I want to set goals. I want to have different experiences. I want to work with top players. I want to help develop people and improve people. I want to enjoy experiences, definitely. But for me, it's just about keep your head down, keep working hard, see where it takes me. Still relatively young, still very ambitious. And I think my experiences have given me different skills, lots of different skills that could take me into lots of different roles and lots of different environments. So I want to be open-minded about what that might be. So I know it's a bit of a fluffy answer. But I genuinely don't know. I get asked that question so much. I genuinely don't know. I'm just enjoying where I'm at. I want to compete in what I'm doing every day. I want to keep enjoying it and see where it takes me.
Excellent. Yeah, Aaron, just start to come to a point of this conversation where, you know, we've summed up your journey to date. I'm just interested now, you know, if I gave you 60 seconds now to kind of lend a golden nugget or two for the listeners and viewers, what would that be?
Yeah, I mean, it's got to be personal to you. It's got to be like your personal journey. Find your passion, follow your passion and work as hard as you possibly can at it. I think for me, for coaches, when I'm looking at coaches or is looking to recruit coaches or anything like that, we came up with kind of like this strap line of know the game, teach the game, beat the game. So game knowledge is important and credibility is important. And you've got to be a student of the game. So there's no getting away from that. So get as many experiences as you can, coach many different people as you can, and get that knowledge, that game knowledge, not just how the game's played, but how the game's taught, all that kind of stuff. Teach the game, I think, is important. So we can teach in so many different ways now. And I think, again, this pandemic is showing us that sometimes we've got to teach virtually. Sometimes we've got to teach through a WhatsApp message. Sometimes we've got to teach on a webinar. Sometimes we've got to put video clips together and make sure they're really simple and understanding for the players. We've got to teach in every training session. So you got to be a good teacher of the game. And then beat the game, for me, is the exciting part. It's like, what's next? Where can we take this game next? How can we innovate? How can we be better than what's gone before us? What's coming next? Who our next opponents are? Because everybody around the world and every other team are competing and trying to get better. So we've just got to keep that going as well ourselves. So, yeah, for me, know the game, teach the game, beat the game is the exciting stuff.
Fantastic. And, you know, just on a final note then, you know, just by being here, having this conversation with me, you've made yourself part of the coaches network. So on that note, what's the message that you want to leave behind for the rest of the network? What do you want to be known for?
I mean, at this current time, stay safe. Protect our loved ones, but protect our young players. I think in this current situation that we're going through, the pandemic, I think we have to be really mindful of the players, and let's start future proofing it. So when we come out of it, what we're going to do better than what we've done before? How are we going to support them? How are we going to help them catch up on what they may have missed out on? But I mean. Thanks to guys like you and putting stuff together like this, and the time and the effort that you put into it, and the fantastic array of speakers that you've had and guests you've had before me are really, really inspiring. So there's loads out there that we can continue to learn from. So keep learning, keep being passionate, and let's protect our young players and look after them.
Fantastic. Well, Aaron, I want to thank you again for your time today. It's been very enjoyable for me to have this conversation with you. I'm sure it will be for the listeners and viewers as well. Just on a final note, if there is any listeners or viewers out there that have any questions around some of the stuff that we've discussed in this conversation or beyond, is there somewhere they could get in touch with you to do that?
Yeah, I'm searchable on LinkedIn. So just my name, Aaron Danks, on LinkedIn. But probably the easiest one would be Twitter. So I'm on Twitter at Coach Danks, quite interactive on there and willing to, yeah, please reach out if there's any questions, if anything anybody needs. Yeah, more than happy to help.
Perfect. Thank you again, Aaron, for your time. I really enjoyed that and hope you have a great day.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Well, there you have it, guys. Another episode of the Coaches Network podcast, where our aim is to bring the world of athlete, talent and personal development together to just one platform. And you can help us with that mission right now by sharing this episode or any of your favorite episodes with everyone that you can think of. You can tag us in those mentions as well on Instagram at the Coaches Network or on Twitter at the Coaches Net. We look forward to hearing from you. Let us know what you thought about today's episode. And until next time, guys, take care.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.